If you're like most people, money feels complicated, overwhelming, or even intimidating. But it doesn't have to be. Today, I'm joined by Ann Lester, author of Your Best Financial Life and former J.P. Morgan executive, who has made it her mission to help people turn money stress into money strength. Ever wish you had a roadmap for your money and your legacy that actually makes sense? You're in the right place. Welcome to Money Sense, where we have spent over 36 years helping people planning not just for the finances, but for their whole life. My guest today is Ann Lester. She is a speaker, author, and a money mentor. And her goal is to help millennials and Gen X transform their relationship with money. Welcome to the show, Ann.
Thanks so much for having me.
You know, I really enjoy this portion of the conversation because I've been a financial advisor for almost 40 years working with clients, and we have gone through so many transitions now of working with our clients, working with their children, and happy to say, but it ages me, and working with their grandchildren.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And people struggle around money. Parents that have a lot of money struggle about passing money on, wanting to have their kids really learn about money and be independent on their own. And so I'm curious I know why I need this and why my clients need it, but I'm curious as to why you decided to focus on this area and write this book. What prompted you?
Well, this book specifically, it's the book I wish I'd had when I was in my 20s. My parents were born in the 30s. They, you know, were teachers. My dad was a university professor, you know, first generation to kind of make it as white collar professionals. And they didn't teach us a whole lot about money. I said something like that once to my mom, and she said, "Well, Ann, we just figured you'd figure it out. It's not that hard." And I thought, well, actually, it's a little bit hard. So it's the book I really wish I had. And the thing that I felt very strongly is that when people in their 20s and 30s, they don't understand, you know, our brains aren't wired to understand the power of time and how important time is as part of this equation about how you build and maintain wealth. So you can save money, you can have returns, but the magic is really in the compounding of that over decades. And the earlier you start saving, the less you have to save. And that's a lesson I wish I'd learned a little earlier in my life.
You and me both. But
yeah.
And money feels complicated, and yeah, it can be overwhelming, and even for many people, intimidating, but it really doesn't have to be. And I think that your book helps people to understand that, and kids, that not only just about the compounding, but having these conversations around money are really important, and reaching out to people and talking about it. I grew up in an era, and I'm sure maybe your parents' type era, where everything was private. Nobody talked about money. And now it's a changing voice.
I think peers are more comfortable, and certainly younger peers are more comfortable talking about money. There's a woman who does these great interviews with people about their salaries and sort of radical transparency. And I think that's really healthy, actually. When I was doing research for the book, I discovered that more parents would rather talk to their children about sex than money. And let's be honest, we don't really have that conversation about sex with our kids very well either. So this is, you know, it's I think many parents feel like they're not doing it right. I think they get stuck with, I'm not doing this right. How can I teach my child? They feel their own sense of shame and guilt. And so I think when you're feeling bad about yourself, it's hard to feel like you can teach anybody anything. And certainly if you're feeling financial stress, we know from a lot of research that it actually shuts down our decision-making capacity. Like, it makes us impoverished mentally when we're feeling financial stress. And so it's just a hard place to lead, to teach, to share from. And, you know, I think the other thing most people underestimate is how early children start forming their ideas about what money is and how it works. And, you know, there's a lot of research showing that children, by the time they're 8 or 9, have actually got a pretty good understanding of what money is and how it works and how it can give people power or take power away from people if you don't have it. I think most parents don't really feel like they need to start having the air quote money conversations until their kids are teenagers at best, or maybe even start, you know, working and getting their first jobs, whether that's in high school or college. So I think parents wait too long, and then it's kind of hard to undo things if those attitudes are already set in stone. It's never too late. And that's a message I very firmly believe in my book. But the earlier you start, the better on all of this stuff.
Well, I think one of the things that I learned through working with clients and starting very young, because when I first started, I was working with a lot of people who were building wealth, not as much as now I work with a lot of people who have created wealth. But when they were building wealth and we were talking about budgeting, that bad word, budgeting.
Scary word. I hate budgeting.
And when you're talking about anybody, you can't create wealth if you don't learn how to budget. And one of the things that I learned was to take that word out of my vocabulary and to talk to my clients and their children about cash flow. Because what I discovered was when I would speak in high schools, I would ask students, how many of you want to own your own business? And all these hands would go up. And then but you know yourself that maybe if you're lucky, only one of those people will own their own business. They will work for someone else and they will create wealth for somebody else. I often say clients and their kids, you know, think about creating wealth as your own company. And that you're building your own company, and every company's got to be diversified. And the number one reason that companies fail is because of cash flow. And so if you can learn cash flow in your own personal wealth, you're way ahead of the game.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I like that.
I grew up with cash in my hand. If I went to the store, my dad used to pull out a wad of money out of his pocket with a rubber band around it, and he would pay for groceries and he'd pay for gas and he'd pay for things. Now everything is charge cards and swiping. And so I think teaching children about money, I think it's hard. It's tricky.
One of the things I'm very grateful for that we did with our children, and it was their nursery school started it. They asked us to give our three-year-olds, right? So they were tiny little kids, but they said, you know, give them a job. And this was back when we had to separate our recycling into paper and newspaper and cardboard. Like it all had to be separate. And we had a special little thing that we'd put our newspapers in. And it was really easy to tie up in a bundle with string. And then they said, please pay them an allowance. And they're going to give half of it to this charity where they were, you know, saving up money to buy a chicken coop for kids in South Africa. And then the school was going to have a chicken coop and they were going to raise chicks together and have this, you know, exchange. And it was lovely. And so we thought, well, this makes sense. Let's keep it going. So we, you know, from the time they were three, we gave them an allowance and we gave them a dollar a week, which, you know, they were born in the 90s and there were still toy stores that you could go visit in person. And there were some really crummy things you could buy for a dollar that would break instantly. And the tiniest little set of Lego was $3. And so we said, you know, kids, if you don't spend your money for a week, you get this thing called interest. So next week, we'll give you an extra dollar for not spending your money. And they were like, 2 weeks and we can buy a Lego set, right? So they immediately learned, but it taught, I didn't even understand that we were teaching them how to delay gratification and save money. And, you know, if you got this money in your hand and then there was the sales tax, and then how did you think about that, right? And it all kind of happened by accident. And it worked brilliantly, you know, and we kept up the allowance. My parents never gave me an allowance. I write about this in the book. The way they taught me to think about money wasn't, do we have enough or not? It was, is this thing something we think is important? And if it is, we'll find the money. And if it's not important, we won't. Which is also, I think, you know, you need to have values as you think about spending your money. But there's also this other thing called, do you have enough or not? And I never figured out how to put those two things together until I was in my 30s, probably. And then I got a credit card in college, right? And then it was game over, which I just didn't know how to use credit either.
Well, not to surprise you, I'm sure, but I would have to say most of our clients, regardless of how much money they have, don't really understand when enough is enough.
Yeah, and it's relative. When I left my corporate job at JP Morgan, my husband and I sat down with our cash flow, and I realized we could stay in our house if neither of us brought in another dime of income. But I had a really hard conversation with myself about what I valued and what I wanted to do with my money. One of the things we're all encouraged to do, I think, is to think carefully about needs, wants, and desires, right? Or you may have another framing for that, but what do we need to survive? I'd like to stay in my house. What do I want to have? I'd like to be able to travel. What do I desire to do? Well, I'd like to travel, in a fancy style that I got used to as a senior executive. Okay. I don't need the fancy, right? But I do want my own bathroom, which is what I boiled it down to. Like when I travel, I don't want to be in a youth hostel. I want my own bathroom. That's very important to me. So it's interesting to discover what you really care about. I think often it's less than we think. We just get used to stuff, right? And we don't really need a lot of it.
Want to keep building wealth that aligns with your values? New episodes of Money Sense drop weekly. Subscribe now and continue learning how your money, your choices, and your life can work together.
When you think about the Gen X and you think about the millennials, they're really set up. I don't want to say failure, that just seems so negative, but in a way it is, with all of the social media and all the junk that comes across that you can buy, you can have with the swipe of a card, and you don't even need to swipe your card. You can do it online and it gets delivered to your front door. And I think that it's really hard for individuals and even adults to look at that idea of what I want right now and to have immediate gratification. Then, I mean, talking to someone so young and talking about retirement, it's hard for them to get their arms around even buying a house or getting a car, or, and then there's student debt. I mean, there's a lot of pressure.
It's the lack of friction, right? Which is what you're talking about for buying things. I still remember having to either get in a car and drive somewhere to buy something, or have a catalog in hand that I could either fill in the tiny slip of paper, write a check, put it in the mail, get a stamp, do the whole thing, or call the number, which not all catalogs even had 800 numbers. So you had to do a toll call. I mean, it was like, it was a big deal to buy something. And there were a lot of places where there could be drop off in the transaction, as you'd say, if you were doing online stuff, right? Where do you lose people in a transaction? Well, I don't have enough gas in my car. My mom said I couldn't have the car. I can't get there today, right? And you don't buy the thing. Now, as you say, it's just a tap, swipe, ooh, I want it. And one of the ways I talk about this a lot in my book is to get more acquainted with your own habits and your own practices about how you tend to spend money. Spend some time thinking about, are there things I regret doing? And if so, what was going on when I regretted that purchase? Like, was I bored and swiping my phone? Was I hungry? Did I feel jealous that somebody could do something I couldn't? Was I primed to do something by something else in my environment? And then you can actually create some rules for yourself. And one of the ones I strongly suggest people think about is, don't let yourself buy something unless you're in a special place at a special time. Like on Saturday afternoon, this is when I buy things. I make a list. I give myself a voice memo. I put something in my notes app, however you want to keep your list. You say, oh, I saw this cute thing. I'm going to think about it. And you actually then give yourself time to sit down and say, okay, what are the things I thought I wanted? Which ones do I actually want right now? Slowing yourself down is enough to put a little gap between that impulse to do it and actually, do I need this? No, I don't.
I think that's a great idea, because I've talked to so many young, my own kids, and they say, oh, I get the bill at the X of the month. And I go, how could I have spent that much on my charge card? And then they start looking at those little things that all add up, and we don't recognize what we're doing. And I have suggested to a lot of people, when you charge your gas, when you do that, write it in your check registry. Just get an extra check registry, and then you will be able to see what's coming out of that account and act as if you've spent cash. Or you've written a check rather than charging, because it catches up to you so very quickly, and it makes you appear like you're just like everybody else. But someone else charging may have the cash in the bank to pay for it, and you don't.
Debit cards are pretty good that way. You don't get the points, but I think, more and more merchants are actually making that transaction a little less, you know, attractive and, you know, maximizing your points. I know there's a lot of people out there that do that. I do that. But if you're struggling to budget, don't use your credit cards. And I think it's good financial planning to have access to credit because emergencies happen. But if you're one of those people that goes, where did all that money go? Don't go there. Just take your credit cards out of your web browser. Take them out of Apple Pay. Don't let yourself hit the easy button. Like, figure out ways to slow yourself down. If you have to pull your card out and type the number in and you're standing on the bus, you're not going to go tap, right? You're going to go, oh, I'm not going to pull my ATM card out here to type the number in my phone in front of everybody. I'm not going to buy that thing right now. But if you've got it all programmed in there, if it's an Apple Pay, you go tap, tap, and whoop, you know, ding, there it goes. So think about ways to slow yourself down.
Let's talk a little bit about the shame around money. And I was trying to think of a way of relating it. But for me, when I have a mess, I just walk by it all the time and I just feel, oh, you know, I got it. I do it. And money can almost give you that same feeling when you've got that shame and you're not getting something done. And it really erodes who you are as a person. And it plays such a negative part on all of your decision-making, how you sleep, everything. And I just always have to take that extra time and clean up whatever it is or organize that closet or do something. And then once it's done, I feel so much better. And I think money is a lot like that. We have to understand it and how it pertains to our life. And each one of us has a different goal in mind. And at each different stage. I mean, right now I'm 76 years old. I'm not saving for my retirement. I'm in my retirement. And, but someone that's your age is more saving and thinking about retirement as well. And your kids are raising families and kids are going to college. Everybody's at a different place. And I think we have to honor that.
Well, I think when we feel shame about something, we actually give it a lot of power. And one of the most difficult things to do, but one of the most liberating things to do is just to acknowledge where you are and say, I mean, for me, the most important thing that happened to me with my own relationship with money was, you know, I had been feeling like it was a moral failing of mine that I couldn't do this. If I were a better person, if I were responsible, if I were smarter, if I wasn't a bad person, I would be able to do this. Well, let me tell you, that's no way to change a habit, right? Beating yourself up and saying, I should have, you know, and it's my fault. And when I was working at JP Morgan, I started spending time in defined contribution running. You know, I managed billions of dollars of other people's money for retirement. And I was trying to figure out how to build a target date fund, which was a very new way to invest money 20, 25 years ago. And I started hanging out with the record keepers who were all learning more about behavioral economics and the power of nudges. And, you know, we need to stop asking people to do it and having them opt out rather than opt in. And I spent a lot of time seeing what other sort of average workers were doing with their money. And it made me feel so much better about myself because I went, oh, I'm not the only one struggling with this stuff. And actually, it's not a moral failing of mine. It's just the way my brain works. Like, I just am wired. I'm a spender. Money has always burned a hole in my pocket. It always has ever since I was a little kid. I have very poor impulse control about food and my personal money. I have brilliant impulse control about investing other people's money. That's a different thing. It lives in a different part in my head. But for me, food and spending, you could set me down in a store with no price tags and I will unerringly find the single most expensive thing in the store and fall in love with it and have to have it. Like, I am just that person. So once I learned that, it was like, this is not because I'm bad or good. It's just like, okay, this is the way I'm wired. I can work with this. What do I need to do to make sure I don't lean into the brain, the way my brain is working, and instead put some guardrails around it?
I think many people are like that. And you'll love what I tell my kids around food. I want them to put fasting at last on my gravestone.
Well,
Because I'm just like that too. I enjoy cooking. I love eating. I love going out. I love all, and it's hard unless you actually take time to write down what you're eating to understand what you're eating. Same as spending.
It's that it's so easy to do unconsciously now. You know, there's no work involved in any of it now. I mean, you know, 100 years ago, there was a whole lot of work involved in any of these things that we had to do. Like you had to go find it and get it and do it. And now it just like arrives, as you said, by magic at your front door. So society has been very good at figuring out how to make it easy for us to do things that will kind of ultimately be kind of bad for us, whether it's with food or money, you know, it's all the easy stuff, right? And it's not correspondingly easy to do the things that are healthy for us. And it, you know, recognizing that is a very important first step to figuring out what you want to do. And now I firmly believe that you don't save money for its own sake. You save money for a purpose. And, you know, money is here to facilitate us doing the things we want to do in life. It's not something we hoard and like, you know, you win if you have the biggest balance in your bank when you die, because that's like, what's the point of that, right? But, right. But I do think it's important to think about decisions that we're making today that we don't know we're making. And that's where, again, my focus on the 20s and 30s and 40-somethings is you're making a lot of decisions around money that you don't understand you're making unconsciously, and you may regret them later. I'd like you to understand the trade-offs that you're really making unconsciously and make them more consciously. Then you decide what you want to do with it, but at least you'll have better information.
I think that's great. One of the things I like to always try to think about for myself is every time I say yes to something, I'm saying no to something else.
Exactly.
And once we can get to that point that we can do it early on rather than later on, you have such an opportunity, as you said, just about the time in the market and being able to grow your money. My guest today is Ann Lester. She is a speaker. She's an author and a money mentor, trying to help the young millennials and the Gen Xers really transform their relationship with money. She has written a great book, Your Best Financial Life, and it's on all the places you can buy a great book. But what a wonderful gift to give your kids and read it yourself. Because if you buy a book like this and you take a chapter or two at a time and you sit down and have a cup of coffee or do it over the phone with your kids and say, what'd you think about that chapter? And you can relate to what you learned over time and maybe save them a couple steps on their own where they don't have to make some of the same mistakes that we did, because we weren't informed. People didn't talk about money. And so we're going to take a quick break. And with that, we will be right back.
Money Sense is brought to you by Ellen Becker Investment Group. If you're looking for a trusted partner or ready to elevate your financial plan, you're in the right place. With multiple Better Business Bureau Torch Awards for ethics and integrity, Ellen Becker combines expertise with a team member you can trust. Meet our advisors and explore financial resources at ellenbecker.com.
Welcome to Money Sense, and I hope that you're enjoying our conversation. We're talking about millennials. We've actually been talking about all of us through the ages, because money is one thing that follows us all along from the time when you're little until you're older, and you have different relationships with it. And as we've been talking, I'm wondering if we can talk a little bit about the steps. We sort of set the stage for the why, and the why is most important, but then it's also how to get there. My guest today is Ann Lester, and we've been talking, as I said, about money. And she also wrote a great book, Your Best Financial Life. And I think ultimately that's what we want for our kids. And if you were to ask anybody, they'd say, What do you want for your financial future? They say, I want to be able to be independent, and I want to be able to make choices and have choices. So, Ann, how does someone get there?
It's not an overnight process, right? It's slow and steady for most of us. Now, there's obviously exceptions, and we read about them online. We see them in our Instagram feeds, you know, but for most of us, we're going to get there the slow and steady way. And, you know, I have a 5-step framework. It's called Building Your Stash, STASH. The first step in that is saving for a rainy day, having an emergency savings fund. And it's, you know, what I recommend everybody start with right when they start earning their first paycheck. Make sure you've got 3 to 6 months living expenses stashed away. That is because you're trying to eliminate things that will really, really mess you up If you are needing your car to get to work and you need to put 4 new tires on all of a sudden, that's you know, $800 that you didn't know you needed to spend, right? And if you didn't have a little car fund going to take care of your car repairs, it will happen periodically. Suddenly you're, you know, I need my car because I can't go to work without my car. I've got bald tires. I got to get this taken care of. So that emergency savings fund can kick in and buy your new tires for you. The reason we say 3 to 6 months is because if you are unlucky enough to lose your job, that's a bit of a cushion to tide you over and make sure you've got time to look for something that's going to work for you and not necessarily just grab the first thing that comes along because you can't pay your rent. So it's really that notion of making sure you can handle an emergency car repair, a medical expense, or you know, again, if that ultimate thing happens and you lose your job, you can tide yourself over. It is not to let you go on a fun vacation that you didn't save up for. That is not what your emergency fund is for. It is for an emergency. You should be saving ahead for your vacations. At the same time or next on the list, and it depends a little bit, you should start saving for retirement. Now, if you're working for an employer that offers a workplace savings program like a 401k or a 403b, it's all alphabet soup, but it's basically a way that your employer will set you up with a retirement account. Typically, you can put that money in before you pay taxes on it. Typically, your employer will match some or even all of that money. So an average way that they match is they match 50% of what you put in up to a certain limit, typically 3 to 6%. So what you're getting from your employer is free money. So you should get all the free money. So you should start your emergency savings fund. If you've got that workplace savings and they're giving you free money, get the free money. So again, maybe you work up to a 6% contribution rate if you're earning $50,000. 1% of that is $250, I think. My percentages may be off. But you want to start putting in that percent of your salary so that you can get up to, if you're earning $100,000, 6% would be $6,000 a year. That's $500 a paycheck you'd be putting into retirement savings. And if you do that, your company's going to match half of it. That's free money. And then you do the next important thing, which is assess your budget and pay down your debt. So if you've got credit card debt, you've got high interest rate student loan debt, you focus on paying that down next. And after you do that, you stay the course and you max out on your tax advantage savings. So that's the fourth step. First step, rainy day fund. Second step, start getting that tax advantage savings. STA, assess your budget, start working on your high interest rate debt. Once that's paid down or well underway, then you start bumping up the amount that you're saving for retirement until you get to 10 to 15% of your pre-retirement income. And there's a bunch of information in my book about how you figure out exactly what you should be saving, but rule of thumb, 10%. If you're starting out, that's an amazing target. You should be trying to get there. And then the last thing you do with your money, the H, is have fun. Once you've tackled your emergency savings fund, you've paid down your high interest rate debt, you're maxing out your retirement savings, that's when you get to save for the really fun stuff. So that's the five steps you should be following.
And when you talk about in your book about those steps, if somebody has a huge amount of debt, if they have, and they just feel so almost unconscious around it, what are some of the emotional steps that they can take to start overriding that negative self-talk?
So this sounds kind of overly simplistic, and to some extent it is, but it's kind of like just looking at the monster you think is under your bed. Once you look at it and you understand how big it is and you accept that it's there, it's a little bit easier to actually start chipping away at it. So, I mean, I lived like this for a decade, right? Oh, I can't believe I did this. Oh, I'm so ashamed. What would people say? You know, I can't, you know,
remorse.
What would my parents say if they knew how much credit card debt we were floating every month, right? I mean, it was terrible. And this insight into the behavioral economics and my kind of looking back and understanding how I got there, and just saying, okay, like maybe there's a little bit of emotional maturity involved in this as well. I was a mom suddenly, and I'm like, all right, you got to get this, you got to clean this act up, kid. Like, you know, suddenly there are other people involved. It's not just me. But some of it was just kind of finding the grace to look at it and say, okay, this is what you are. This is what you did. Now what? Let's start. You know, there is this sort of one step at a time, and it is something you can read on a inspirational calendar, but it's also true. The hardest things start with just one step. And I think one of the things about the stash methodology is once you take that first little step and you start putting a little bit into a savings account, suddenly you're a saver. Like you started reframing your own view of yourself.
I can think of one of my clients, and she's probably been a client for 30 years, but she came to me. I did a talk and she heard it, and she came to me as kind of a woman to a woman and really said, I am buying all these books, self-help books, and I'm buying all these plants and I buy cards. And she said, I just spend money. And she said, I know I'm not going to ever have any money. And we started with, I'm not going to say budgeting, cash flow, just understanding. It's almost like when you're eating and writing down your calories to get an idea of what are you actually eating. And we eat unconsciously, we spend unconsciously. And what I found was when she eventually saved $1,000, she just got so excited. And then it was $5,000, and then it was $10,000. And now I have to say she has over $1 million saved for her retirement. And we talk about it whenever she comes in and she'll say, oh, Karen, I remember sitting down and I was buying all this stuff and things that I wasn't even using and buy books that I didn't read. And now she's been able to save for her future and has a comfortable retirement. But it was little steps. It was little wins that just got her so excited. And I know, you know, like I said, told the kids to put fasting at last on my gravestone. For me, it's the little wins. You lose a few. At first, it's so hard to get started. You lose 2 or 3 pounds. You go, yay. You know, it's for everybody's different, but it's the little wins, I think, that really help us to keep moving forward.
I think one of the things that's really challenging for Gen Zers and millennials, for Gen Xers, everybody, is the framing around it, right? Retirement crisis, you have to save $2 million. You know, I just said it, you have to save 10 to 15%. If you're just starting out, that's an insane number. All of those numbers are insane, right? You're just like, that's never going to be me, like your client said. And here's the thing, if you start with 1%,
yes.
And you promise yourself the next time you get a raise or a bonus or a tax refund or a gift of money, save half of it. You get a 5% raise, put 2.5% of that into savings. Now your 1% savings rate has turned into 3.5% savings. And you have more money to spend. So you're not depriving yourself of something you want right now. And if you've got a tight budget, sometimes it can be very hard to find like more money to save. So don't sweat it. You are where you are today. Next time you get a raise, save it. And then suddenly it's, I don't want to say it's painless, but it's much less painful than trying to cut back on stuff you're already doing. I think it's a very worthy exercise to look at your cash flow and say, what is the stuff that I'm spending money on that's not bringing me joy or meaning or that I don't actually need? But let's be honest, some people who are listening to this podcast are like, yeah, I've already done that. I still got it. I've still got trouble, right? My rent just went up, right? So if you're in that boat, give yourself a little grace and say, great, I know what I'm going to do with my next raise. And it's not going to be to buy a new car. It's going to be to put it into savings.
I think a lot of times people also make the mistake of saying, I'm going to save $100. I'm going to save $50 out of every paycheck. And that was when they were making one income. And 5 years or 10 years later, they've made triple the income and they're still saving their $50 out of a paycheck. I love your idea of doing a percentage, because that way, as your income increases, you're saving more without even thinking about it.
You will get into big trouble if you start out at the default savings rate for most 401k plans, which is typically 5% or 3%. Don't get me started on why that's terrible. But if you never change it and your employer doesn't change it for you, you are wildly undersaving for your own retirement. You really do eventually in your 30s, ideally, but even in your 40s or 50s, need to get up to that 10 to 15% rate. And as your income goes up, you can increase the percentage you're putting away and still feel the benefit of some of that lifestyle increase, right? We all want to be, like, none of us really want to be living the way we were living when we got our first job, right? I had a roommate. You know, I had the laundry in the basement, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, I don't want to live like that for the rest of my life. And the way you do that is not to take your entire raise and increase your spending. You know, it's consumption creep, because if you let yourself do that, you'll never get out of that hole. You've got to do both at the same time. And so again, when you time your savings increases to any increase in income, and if you take any windfall you get, again, a gift, a tax refund, a bonus from work, and you don't spend all of it and you save some of that, that's how you start really building up those numbers. And then once you see it working, it's easier to do.
You know, and I want to bring up a subject that just was something that happened recently with a new client that was coming in, and they were in a panic mode because they had relied in their mind that their parents were wealthy and they were going to inherit a sizable amount of money. And so they didn't save. They spent, and they saved a little, but they didn't really save because in their mind, we were going to inherit. And what happened is both of their parents came down with memory loss and Alzheimer's, and almost the entire estate has been used up. A lot of money has been used up, and there was a lot of money there. But one of the things that we tell our clients is we can help them with taxes. We can help them how we invest a portfolio with the volatility. We can help them with some of those things. But what we can't really help them with is any issue that comes up with health. And health is sort of the unknown. And I think a lot of times kids make a mistake thinking, well, my parents have quite a bit of money and I'm going to inherit. And yes, there is a lot of money being transferred from one generation to the next, but it doesn't necessarily always mean it's going to transfer to you.
It's a really interesting challenge. You know, I'm involved in a lot of policy conversations and sort of how do we design pensions and how do we build products that will help people manage this sort of saving? And then how do you spend it once you retire? Because that's actually kind of hard to do if you've been trained to save all your life. Actually spending it can be quite difficult for some people. I'm looking at my parents, which I will ultimately be the beneficiary of. But like, guys, you should spend some more money. Like, you saved it. It's, you know, the purpose of this savings was not to hoard. It was to use on making your life better. But there's this real hug between needing to save enough to make sure you can live a life of decency in old age. And frankly, if you've got means, you know, and you come down with memory care issues or even just need skilled nursing for more than a couple years, that's, you know, my father needed skilled nursing for 2 years and he was at a very nice facility, but it was, you know, like $15,000 a month. It's a lot. It's
and
really
if
a
all
lot.
Their money is in retirement accounts, they're taxed on it. So they don't get to use that straight. They are going to be taxed on it. So well, you really have to understand.
I very much wrote my book for people who are just getting started. And I think we can quickly overwhelm people with all of these things that on the margin are incredibly important, like do you do Roth or regular, you know, do you put some of your money in a regular brokerage account to actually help you manage your taxes when you're taking it out, right? This is all incredibly important stuff, all other things being equal. Fiduciaries, right, always want to be acting in their client's best interest and needing to think about all of this stuff. Sometimes it makes the decisions that beginners are making feel like it's too easy to do it wrong and therefore I don't want to do anything at all. And really, there are only two really big mistakes you can make. The first mistake is not saving anything at all. That's a really big mistake. Please don't do that. The second big mistake you can make is leaving it all in cash because it feels easier to do, safer to do. I don't want to buy the wrong thing. I don't want to make the wrong investment. What if it goes down? I'll feel terrible. Safer to leave it in cash. That is a terrible decision because it won't grow. It won't grow after inflation, and you will lose one of the biggest benefits you have, which is compound return. So if you're not saving and you're not investing, those are two big mistakes. Those are the wrong things to do. Everything else that you could do is a better thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's some better or slightly less better, but we're already in the camp of like, should you buy an S&P fund? Should you buy we can talk about the relative pros and cons of any of those decisions, how to invest it, how to diversify. Do you do it yourself? Do you buy a target date fund? Like, those are all great conversations. Don't overthink it. If you're starting, just start.
I think it's the starting. Don't depend on anyone else or anything else. Don't depend on winning the lottery.
Yeah, bad strategy.
Do it for yourself. Get yourself in the position that you have choices and that you can be independent.
Yeah.
We only have a few minutes left. My guest today is Ann Lester. She is the author of Your Best Financial Life. As I said early, it's a great book. And Ann, I would just ask you, I know that we've already talked and you said that later can be the detriment to all of your savings. Start now. But what is your advice to those who are listening and they already feel that they're behind? What would you say to someone who, here it is, you know, what do we do? What do they do?
I read a line in a novel that I'm going to butcher. And it was a character whose mother was reprimanding her. And it was like, oh, so you didn't have enough time to do it right the first time. So you decided you'd take even more time and do it again. Like there is, waiting isn't going to make this any better, right? So that's part of it. And I've heard a lot of young people say this. I've heard my kids' friends say this. Well, I have to save so much. I can't save that much. So I might as well not bother. I'll take that money and go on a trip instead. And it's actually not true. You should always bother. You can always be better off by saving a little bit of money. And if you really look at your cash flow, I love that framing and not budget, but look at your cash flow. If you honestly, hand over heart, can say there is nothing that I am spending money on now that is not something I really needed, then great. I agree. You probably can't start saving today, but you know what? The next time you have a little bit of money, tax refund, raise, bonus, gift, please, please, please open a savings account and start that emergency savings fund. That's the biggest gift you can give yourself. And then keep it up, because you will look back in a very short amount of time. If you're saving $50 a month or $100 a month, 1% of your salary, you'll turn around and in just a few months, that's going to be real money. And that is the most empowering thing in the world, because then, as Karen, as you said, you will have choices.
And thank you so much for being my guest today. And this has been just a wonderful opportunity to talk about money. And I think that it's a conversation that we really do have to keep alive and keep going. Thank you so much and have a great week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Money Sense, brought to you by Ellen Becker Investment Group. If you found today's conversation helpful, we encourage you to share it with a friend or family member. And be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts so you never miss an episode. At Ellen Becker Investment Group, we believe that education is the foundation of confident financial decisions. That's why we're proud to bring you insights from experienced professionals to help you build true wealth beyond just money. Please note, this podcast is intended for general informational purposes only and does not constitute personalized financial advice. Before making any financial decisions, we recommend consulting with a qualified advisor who understands your unique situation. For more resources, visit ellenbecker.com. We'll be back soon with more insights to help you live with clarity and confidence.